Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am currently in Genesis 7, verses 1 through 12 for this audio. I've entitled this section, Noah Loads the Ark, and the Waters Come. Our context is this. In chapter 6, verses 9 through 22, the previous chapter, Noah's Ark was built, and we see the construction of the Ark. So we start now in Genesis 7:1. Then the Lord said to Noah, "Enter the Ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you alone are righteous before me in this generation." Now, when God says that Noah is righteous, this of course does not imply sinless perfection. It rather means that Noah was sincere in his desire to do God's will, as Jameson Fawcett Brown define it. You'll recall that Noah got drunk after the flood in that famous scene in the cave, which we'll talk about when we get there. So we see that he's not a perfect guy, but he was righteous, and we see that in various scriptures. For example, Genesis 6:9, these are the family records of Noah. Noah was a righteous man. Blameless among his contemporaries, Noah walked with God. 2 Peter 2:5, and if he, God, didn't spare the ancient world but protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and seven others when he brought a flood on the world of the ungodly. Righteousness here just shows that Noah loved God. That's basically what it means. It doesn't mean he was sinlessly perfect. Hebrews 11:7, by faith Noah, after he was warned about what was not yet seen and motivated by godly fear, built an ark to deliver his family. By faith he condemned the world and became an heir of righteousness that comes by faith. Noah inherited righteousness because of his faith, his belief in God. Think about it. You look around, the skies are blue. Bright cotton ball cumulus clouds in the sky. The sun is shining brightly. The sky is blue. I think I said the clouds are blue. The sky is blue. Everything is just sunny. And all of a sudden, God says, build an ark because I'm going to wipe the earth out with a flood. Well, that takes faith to believe that because your sight says, no, there's no flood coming. Just like the ungodly thought. Now, Noah was righteous. This was a great contrast to the sin that was all around Noah. And to me, that presents a great application. Believers are constantly surrounded by sinners who want to defy God with every breath they take. So God has to judge them. But in the process of that judgment, he saves the righteous, gives them an ark of safety. Now, when did God say this to Noah? Enter the ark 7 days before the rains came, as we'll see in a later verse. Who went into the ark? Noah and his household. That would be Noah, Noah's wife, Noah's three sons, and his three daughters-in-law, the three wives of those three sons, eight people. He says, God says, enter the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous. In other words, I'm not going to drown you because you worship me. That's why you're not going to drown. For, because you are righteous. Righteousness has its dividends, folks, loving God. You want your house built on the sand or built on a rock? Genesis 7:2-3, you are to take with you seven pairs, a male and its female. This is God continuing to talk to Noah. A male and its female of all the clean animals and two of the animals that are not clean, a male and its female. And seven pairs, male and female, of the birds of the sky in order to keep offspring alive on the face of the whole earth. Now we often hear the little kid song about the animals going on two by two on the ark. Well, actually, it was clean animals. It was seven pairs, not two by two, but seven pairs. Well, I guess they're going on by pairs. I guess that is two by two. But there was seven pairs for the clean animals and two for the unclean animals. Why? Why not seven pairs for the unclean animals? Well, the NIV Study Bible says that there were more clean animals that were needed than unclean animals. After all, clean animals would be sacrificed. They would be eaten. Unclean animals weren't. And maybe Noah might have even sacrificed on the ark, as Jameson Fawcett Brown suggests. So if you have seven pairs, and those pairs maybe perhaps had children while this adventure was going on, 200 and some odd days of floating around on the ocean, maybe those offspring could have provided more sacrifices or more food. But at any rate, there's more clean animals than unclean animals on the ark. There's another reason why you might not have so many unclean animals. A lot of the unclean animals were harmful to man, as John Gill points out. Lions, wolves, tigers, bears, you don't want a lot of those unclean animals on the ark. You'd be managing a circus. And those animals could kill you if they got loose. Hard to manage. They only had eight people on the ark. So maybe that's why there were only It was only one pair of the unclean animals. Well, it says two. That's probably two pair. No, it's just probably two single animals that are not clean. Two unclean animals where you got 14 clean animals of each kind. Now, the fact that Moses is even distinguishing clean and unclean animals here at Noah's time shows that clean and unclean animals were distinguished even before the law. John Gill says that men were probably directed by God how to sacrifice the clean animals you sacrifice, the unclean ones you don't, to show that God gets the best. Now, when it comes to the birds in verse 3, we have a translation problem. God says, seven pairs, male and female, of the birds of the sky you're supposed to put on the ark. Well, it could be seven pairs, as the Home of Christian Study Bible has it, but it also could be translated seven birds of each kind. In other words, it's either the 14 birds of each kind or seven birds of each kind. It can go either way, translator's choice. But the purpose of all this was so that after the flood, the earth could be repopulated and God could start over, fixing the mess that human beings had made. Genesis 7:4, 7 days from now I will make it rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will wipe off from the face of the earth every living thing I have made. That's God speaking to Noah again. Now, 40 days and 40 nights of rain, 40 days and 40 nights is an especially significant time. It's a redemptive period of time. Let's look at some scriptures. Verse 12 in the same chapter, Genesis 7, and the rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Deuteronomy 9:11, the Lord gave me the stone tablets, the tablets of the covenant, at the end of the 40 days and 40 nights. That was the time that Moses was up on the mountain communing with God in order to get the Mosaic law. Matthew 4:1-2, then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. So there's a 40 day and 40 night fast. That's a spiritual event. 1 Kings 19:8, so he, Elisha, got up at 8 and drank. Then on the strength from that food, he walked. That's Elijah, I'm sorry, not Elisha. Then on the strength from that food, he walked 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God, Mount Sinai. So you've got Elijah walking to the mountain of God 40 days and 40 nights. Jonah 3:4. Jonah set out on the first day of his walk in the city and proclaimed, in 40 days, Nineveh will be demolished. And by the way, 40 days and 40 nights basically means 40 days. That's just the way the Hebrews said it. So that when you see that phrase, 40 days and 40 nights, that means something special is happening. Now, this is an extraordinarily long rain, as John Gill says. That is a long time for it to rain, if you think about it. I lived in a city in China, Ningbo, China, and the local natives there told me they'd never seen so much rain like that in their lives, and they'd lived there all their life, and I never have either. I mean, it never stopped raining. It rained every single day for a semester. What is that, 90 days? So I know how that is. Well, I might be exaggerating a little bit. It might have been 1 or 2 days of sunshine, but the mold was all over our walls. I just got used to driving in the rain and going and getting to class totally wet. Never seen anything like it. So I can imagine it was kind of gloomy. 40 days and 40 nights of rain, that is gloomy. Especially when you see the judgment coming and living creatures are getting killed. Now, every living thing that's going to be wiped off the face of the earth, as God says here in verse 4, that's referring to animal life only. Plant life still survived. Genesis 8:11, we read this. When the dove came to him at evening, that was the dove that Moses had let loose from the ark to see if there was some dry land anywhere. When the dove came to him at evening, there was a plucked olive leaf in her beak. So there's some plants. So Noah knew that the water on the earth's surface had gone down. Now, the fact that plant life is still living and animal life has been wiped out, skeptics use that to ridicule the Bible, as they always do. They love to trash God's holy word. The skeptics say, how can plants and seeds last a year in water? Well, let's look at some salient facts here. First of all, the earth was not covered with water for the entire flood year. It's not 1 year. The longest possible time plants could be under the water is 278 days. That's because the floods took a while to cover the earth, and also they took a while to recede. The calculations are in an article and answers in Genesis where you come up with that 278 days, and I'm going to assume they're right. So it's not a whole year. It's 278 days that the plants have got to survive, or their seeds have got to survive. We need to note that the salinity of the water in Noah's time is probably less than the salinity of the water today, or at least it very well could be. Remember, the waters are coming up from under the earth when the crevices in the ground are cracked open and the underground streams flow up. and flood the earth. That's where most of the flood came from. That's probably not salt water. Rain is not salt water, so the salinity is probably less than the oceans of today. And also, species today could be less robust than they were at the flood. After all, we've had at least 4,400 years of speciation and mutation as time has gone on from the flood, and that means that the plants of flood time could have been a lot stronger than they are today. And even today, we have many species of trees that actually thrive in water. The white cedar, the eastern hemlock, the loblolly pine, the black spruce, the red maple, the elm, the pin oak, and the birch. All kinds of trees love those swamplands. So you see, already it doesn't seem so unlikely that plant life could survive. Well, I'm going to give you five options as to how you could answer the skeptic's charge that plants can't live for 278 days underwater. First of all, there could be built-in survival mechanisms when the plants were created, when God made the plants. Well, that's kind of a punt, but it could be. Second option, the seeds would survive underwater. They would take root and regrow after the waters receded. Let's go back to the famous dove with the olive leaf, which was on day 278. It's 128 days after the ark rested on Ararat. So the ark's sitting there for 128 days on dry land, which means in certain areas of the earth that there was dry land. And that would give time for the seeds, having gone through the water, to regerminate. And it also give time for the olive tree to actually grow during that 128 days that the ark is resting on Ararat. Third option to answer, how the plants survived the flood. Plants were taken on board the ark. There could have been cereal plants whose seeds were not able to survive underwater. Because remember, Noah and his family had to have something to eat, and they were eating vegetable plants. So they would have been on the ark, and they could have been planted after the ark rested. We know in Genesis 9:20 that Noah replanted a vineyard. Where did he get the grape seeds from? Unless he carried them with him when he went on board. Also, you've got animals who ate of these plants. These animals had to be eaten too on the ark. And they eat of the plants, and they have seeds in their excrement, and then they pass those seeds when they go to the bathroom after the flood. So there's another possibility of how seeds might have survived. Also, there might have been vegetation mats of floating debris floating around on the water, and then twisted up trees and plants could have been caught in those mats of vegetation. And they would contain seeds, which could regerminate and grow when the waters dropped those mats back down to the ground. A fifth possible reason that the seeds could last is that herbivorous animals who were floating dead on the water, they could have protected seeds in their bodies. They could have eaten, got wiped out by the flood, and they float around dead in the water. And then when they die, their bodies rot, and the seeds are there, and they germinate. Now, I have an interesting quote here from Charles Darwin, Mr. Evolution himself. This is from his famous book, The Origin of Species. He says this. This is The Origin of Species, Chapter 12, entitled Geographical Distribution. And there's a subsection there called Means of Dispersal. Darwin had done some saltwater studies. This is in the Signet Mass Market paperback book published in New York, originally published, of course, in 1859, on page 349. Quote, this is what Darwin says, quote, again, I can show that the carcasses of birds when floating on the sea sometimes escape being immediately devoured, and many kinds of seeds in the crops of floating birds long retain their vitality, but some taken out of the crop of a pigeon, which had floated on artificial seawater for 30 days, to my surprise, nearly all germinated. All right, well, that was only for 30 days. We got to go to 278 days, but that's not such a hard stretch. And this is Darwin saying this, folks. It's kind of ironic to see Darwin quoted in a Young Earth Creationist website to try to make a point. But at any rate, I don't have any problem with believing that plants could last during the time of the flood. So skeptics need to really cool their jets. We go now to Genesis 7:5. And Noah did everything that the Lord commanded him. I like that verse, everything that the Lord commanded him. Here's some other scriptures that stress Noah's obedience. Genesis 6:22, and Noah did this. He did everything that God had commanded him. Genesis 7:9, which is four verses coming up. It's going to be repeated. Two of each male and female entered the ark with Noah, just as God had commanded him. Genesis 7:16, those that entered, male and female of all flesh, entered just as God had commanded him. The application of this is very clear. If you don't want to drown as you face the vicissitudes of life, if you don't want to drown, you better do everything just as God tells you, and you'll be okay. But don't start being creative and independent of God, or you might just drown. Genesis 7:6. Noah was 600 years old when the flood came and water covered the earth. That, of course, would be at the very beginning of the flood. Noah was 600 years old. Genesis 7:7-10. So Noah, his son, his wife, and his son's wives entered the ark because of the waters of the flood. From the clean animals, unclean animals, birds, and every creature that crawls on the ground, two of each, male and female, entered the ark with Noah, just as God had commanded him. 7 days later, the waters of the flood came on the earth. Now, all the animals on the ark, I mentioned this in the previous audio. Skeptics love to say the ark's not big enough to handle all the species on the earth. Well, just to summarize that argument, Jameson Fawcett Brown says there's not that many species on the earth. There's maybe not more than 300 kinds. I don't know how he knows that, but I won't go into the details of that argument again. You can listen to the previous audio, which shows that it's very, very easy to assume that there were a few enough animals that Noah could have handled them on that very large ark, by the way. No ship had been found that big until the 1800s AD, 19th century AD. Notice that Moses says here in verse 8, from the clean animals, unclean animals, birds, and every creature that crawls on the ground, no mention is made of fish. Why is that? Well, fish can swim. They don't need saving. They're not going to get wiped out by the flood. Now, the animals entered the ark with Noah. The first question is how did they get there? Well, you know, you could say that Noah led them on there, or they came on divine impulse, perhaps. Well, however they got on there, while Noah was loading them up, the rest of the world was eating, drinking, and working, thinking that everything's going on just fine. And all of those who saw Noah, I'm sure, were saying, "What's the matter with you, boy? Are you crazy? What are you building an ark for in the middle of the dry land? There's no water around here. What are you doing?" Matthew 24:37-39, in the Olivet Discourse, Jesus says this, "As the days of Noah were, so the coming of the Son of Man will be. For in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day Noah boarded the ark. They didn't know until the flood came and swept them all away." So you see that the judgment came upon them unawares, suddenly, without notice, without warning. Kaboom, thunder, rain, the ground's breaking up, and we're cooked. Now in verse 10, the time frame of 7 days is mentioned. 7 days later, the waters of the flood came. Later than what? Well, that was 7 days after God commanded the rains to fall on the earth, as we see in verse 4, Genesis 7, 7 days from now I will make it rain on the earth, and thus 7 days are over, and it's starting to rain. Actually, it doesn't say rain. It says the waters of the flood came on the earth. Those waters came from two sources, the rain and the breaking up of the fountains of the deep coming up through the earth from below. So I don't know when that happened, but the combination of the two sent waters on the earth, and that started 7 days after God told Noah. That gave Noah 7 days to get the animals on the ark. We go now to verses 11 and 12 of Genesis 7. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day all the sources of the watery depths burst open. The floodgates of the sky were opened, and the rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. I notice here something I hadn't noticed till just now in verse 11. On that day, in other words, the day that the flood started, on that day all the sources of the watery depths burst open. So the underground streams that burst through the cracks in the rocks in the ground, which provided the bulk of the flood, that was the same day that it started to rain, we may presume by reading this verse. So waters from above, waters from below, all on the same day. And I imagine there was earthquakes and all causing this, and I imagine the people around Noah were pretty devastated by the whole situation, and they faced cataclysmic doom and ruin. In other words, I don't think this flood was a gentle thing that just happened after the rain rained a long time, and all of a sudden people started to gradually get more and more concerned. The next thing you know, they're up to their necks in water. No, I think it happened pretty fast. So the water came barreling up through crevices in the ground. And by the way, most of the flood came from the ground, not from the sky. John Gill's editor says this, "If all water from the sky fell, That's all. Every bit of water, every molecule of water in the clouds in the sky fell, it would only cover the ground worldwide by 2 inches. So you got to assume that most of this water is coming from below. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we finished chapter 7 of Genesis. We finished chapter 7 of Genesis, the first 12 verses. That gets us ready for the next audio, which will be chapter 7, verses 13 through 24, which I will call The Waters Cover the Earth. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.